This is Tax at the Speed of Tech, a podcast from BDO's Tax Practice. Each episode, we'll connect with inspiring thought leaders to get their take on pressing issues in tax and technology innovation, impactful trends, as well as their predictions for the future.
Data quality is at the heart of digital transformation. We institute data governance by referencing master data, creating audit or error reports, reconciling systems with journal entries, and by establishing roles and authorities with proper access and security. You strive to institute systematic controls, but at some point there enters a need for human review. Changes from systems, regulation, interpretation, materiality, and other complexities cannot always be reasonably automated. Now, most of the data we deal with in tax is structured data, that is, tables of rows and columns of labeled information that can be read, transformed, and consumed. Now, just imagine the difficulty in governing unstructured data. That is what a journalist does. Think about it. A journalist has to synthesize hearsay, blogs, scientific journals, corporate marketing and promotions, and of course, the cesspool that we know as social media. I suppose that in my analogy, fake news is equivalent to an acquired company's legacy ledger system that is different from the corporate and on its own chart of accounts. We look to journalists to transform that data into an output that we can rely on for decision-making. That is an incredible burden that comes with a lot of responsibility, but I'm sure of a lot of excitement as well. My guest today is Chris Gaetano, technology editor at Accounting Today. I cannot wait to talk to him about his unique perspective. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the podcast.
How you doing?
Great. Really excited to talk to you today. Now, given my intro, do you ever yearn for a simple set of facts to analyze, like a trial balance, or do you revel in the thrill of sifting through endless unstructured data to find the truth? And was that a fair analogy?
I mean, I'm gonna be real honest with you and real frank. The answer to that question is largely contingent on how tired I am on a given day, which itself is contingent on what did I eat the night before, how much did I sleep, what's going on. Look, if I've got a lot of vim and vigor on me, which as you can tell from my tone of voice, perhaps I do on a lot of days, I am a total dork. I actually love the time to be able to just really dig into an IRS white paper or something like that and be able to go about with my highlighter, you know, and find all the weird things and being like, ooh, that kind of contradicts something I heard before. Like, this would be a good thing to talk to this one tax partner I know about. This is all in their wheelhouse or something like that. And then, of course, I'm talking to my editor being just like, you will not believe this proposed regulation that's coming in from the IRS. Do you know that back in 2013, they said this thing, now they're saying that thing. It is crazy. But, you know, then if I didn't get a lot of sleep, I do suffer from occasional insomnia, stuff like that. Then it's just like, you know, give me a press release. Let me just read this thing. Is it too apparently puffery or something like that? No. This is more or less the facts. There we go. Good. This new thing is out or something along those lines. So, given if I have my faculties and my wits about me, I love that sort of stuff. That's the sort of thing that I kind of just really have always dug ever since I was a student reporter. You know, a lot of other folks, they liked going to these quick stories. You know, you go report on this event, that event. And of course, I would always do that. But really, my bread and butter, the thing I love to do and the thing that I wanted to really focus my career on was doing these really in-depth analyses where I talk to a whole bunch of people, read a whole bunch of data, you know, and just try to get a better read for a better handle on the situation, you know. Honestly, as a reporter, you are a professional learner. That's a good way to put it, because honestly, like it's a rare thing where an event happens where I know the complete context. I know everything that's going on. I know everything that's going to happen, you know, and even areas that like I may be familiar with. I have a pretty good feeling there's things that I'm missing, you know. And so you talk to a whole bunch of people, you get to the bottom of it and you learn what you learn, you know, and then, of course, being a reporter, you also have to really enjoy talking about the stuff that you learn. And that is kind of, again, a big part of my own personality. I mean, even outside of like accounting or something like that, sometimes I'll like run out of the room, talk to my wife, like, did you hear about what I heard about the rise of the cannon in 19th century Swiss warfare? You know, something along those lines. I didn't even know that orcas have dialects. So it's just par for the course there.
I love the unadulterated enthusiasm. I'm sure the coffee helps. Now, is that enthusiasm and that excitement what led you into the technology angle of accounting? Did you kind of see the excitement over there? I know you started kind of in the accounting side and then migrated over. And I'm speaking with bias, of course, because that's where I find the excitement. But wondering if that was your experience.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to deny that there's certainly a lot of really exciting things going on in the accounting technology arena right now. I mean, especially with the turn towards AI, the really hard drive towards automation. I think that we're in an inflection point at this time. As for my own personal experience, it was mainly that we needed to have really good technology coverage again, because these are the things that are happening right now, you know, in this profession. I started out as more, as you had said, a general sort of accounting reporter. I was covering a lot of different aspects, you know, of this profession, of this industry. But honestly, like, it's kind of, it definitely has been an exciting time to be in this particular coverage area, I do have to say. And yeah, I'll admit, I've always been somebody more tech-minded. I've always been somebody more interested in just overall what's happening in the world of technology. I grew up in a family of early adopters for a lot of tech, which meant I had a lot of really bad tech.
Sure.
Nonetheless, I guess it's always kind of been something within me, you know, something that I've always had a fascination with, an interest with, not just technology itself, but also just the effects, the impact, the larger, you know, societal ripples of technology, and just being able to see and witness these effects over the course of your life. Like, not to date myself or anything like that, but I remember when the iPhone was first introduced, when the idea of a smartphone first came on, and I was still getting used to iPods at that point. Mm-hmm. And now I was actually a latecomer to smartphones. I had a flip phone for quite a long time until I literally dropped it in some water. And then I finally came around to Android at this point. Now I have no idea what I'll do without it, but that's pretty much the entire population, you know?
Yeah, now you're stuck. Now, before we move off of you, we shot right out of a cannon here, and that's perfect. That's the way I like it. But before we move off of you, I did a little bit of LinkedIn stalking here, see that you like to cook for large groups. What's your go-to dish? What do you consider to be a large group?
Okay, so, I mean, the reason I put that in was that I semi-regularly do some volunteer work, cooking community meals. A large
group would be
between, like, during like a warm day, between maybe 50 to maybe 100 people or something like that. If we're talking the deep midwinter, it'll be between maybe 20 to 35 or something, you know, maybe up to 50 if it's like a mild winter day. And as far as actual dishes go, if you suddenly just told me, like, you need to cook for a group of 100 people today, my first instinct would probably be a tomato-based vegetable sauce, because from there, you can use that as a foundation to make a ton of different dishes depending upon who you're cooking for. You know, if you're cooking for a large group of vegetarians or something like that, it easily blends in well with like a lot of very rich, hearty vegetables. You know, you could add some lentils in there for protein, maybe some chickpeas if you're so inclined. If you're cooking for a large group of carnivores, you know, it's pretty simple to like kind of simmer some meat in that and like let the flavors really mix and let the softness of the meat really come out, you know. But yeah, a tomato base, you can turn that into a stunning variety of dishes. And it goes into just like whatever else on the side, you just have some pasta, you know? And honestly, that's kind of my default, you know, meal for a lot of things. It was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're gonna have to cook for everybody listening to the podcast now, because I'm pretty sure at this point in the podcast where everyone thought they were gonna be talking about tax technology, they're just like, why is my stomach grumbling? but I think you stole that answer from the guy.
Fine, you eat the pasta. Maybe it can be a deduction.
There you go. Tie it back. I think he stole that from The Godfather, too. What was the line? You never know when you're going to have to cook for 30 to 40 people when he's cooking the big tomato pot. You know? Yeah. So listen, this is exciting for me. We'll get back to the tax technology now that I am also realizing how hungry I am. This is exciting for me because most guests I talk to have a particular perspective on tax or technology, sometimes both. But you, however, are the first guest who effectively shares the same mission as this podcast, which is to keep a pulse on where the road is heading and to bring folks along with you on that journey. What has it been like to report on this topic over the last decade or so? I know the entire time, as we said, wasn't focused entirely on technology, but, you know, what role did technology play in accounting more broadly when it wasn't your immediate focus? And then what was it like pivoting to technology through that accounting lens?
Okay. So the technology focus honestly came about very gradually. As I talked about before, technology, you know, I certainly did cover accounting technology and business technology and things like that, you know, but it was among many different sort of areas that I was doing. But within there, I was noticing, so I started working for the New York State Society of CPAs, I believe sometime around 2009. And so when I was there working with a trusted professional, I was noticing that tech coverage was starting to ramp up very, very gradually. You know, I remember my very, very first tech story, I think, actually, no, that's not true. I did have to write about XBRL, and that's technically a tech story. But on my own, I had learned about high frequency trading, you know, and just overall the role, how much technology had integrated itself into the world of business, into the world of high finance, even beyond what I had initially even thought. And that kind of led to a lot of other exploration. So for example, this then led into a series just about automation and within large accounting firms in general and things like that, you know, the first sort of explanation about what it's going to, what impacts it might have on the labor pool. I remember talking to accounting educators, talking about how technology is affecting accounting curricula and how we are training the next generation of accountants, you know, to be entering this world and what that means. And then, of course, you see the rise of different technologies and the implications that it has for accounting, you know, just by virtue of the fact that accountants are part of this world and the world is affected, you know, by different technologies. So, for example, blockchain, cryptocurrencies, things along those lines, you know. So, like, I remember back in, like, 2010 or so, I tried to set up a wallet to mine Bitcoin with my phone because that was – you could do that.
Yeah.
Back then, and I gave up after a couple of hours because I'm like, this is way too complicated. And you know what? It's like how many Bitcoins to $1 and who takes it? Like there's one pizzeria in New York that takes it. What do I need this for? Anyway, you see the rise of these things, yeah. You know? And so for example, like and these technology stories, the technology is interesting, but it's almost never about just the technology. You know, I mean, that in and of itself is pretty interesting. But then also just like, what does this mean for the audit? You know, how does this affect the audit? You know, what does this mean for financial reporting? What does this mean for tax? You know, and then also it's like, what does it mean for tax? You know, like, does the IRS have the capacity to even be able to effectively have oversight over this? How are they going to treat this? Is this consistent, you know, with the economic reality of how people are actually using this, you know? And then you even get into questions about hype, about grifterism, about just like people getting like way too into it. So it's really more of a matter of pick your poison, I suppose, you know?
So in picking your poison, right, how do you deal with that hype, right? Because, you know, there's multiple dimensions to those hypes, right? There's the consumer perception of how does this affect me right now? But then there's like with blockchain and Web3 and some of these other things, there's like this long-term seed that needs to grow. Yeah. You know, there isn't that. You know, people dismiss all metaverse and these things like, I'm not using it tomorrow. You know, yesterday it was awesome, but I don't have it yet. So I guess I don't care about that anymore. Right. But it kind of takes the evolution of multiple technologies to then be able to use the real value through the combination of that evolution. So how do you synthesize that for a reader who's probably reading your text saying, why do I care?
I think when it comes to piercing through a lot of the hype and being able to just piece together what's real and what's not, I'm not gonna lie and say that's not challenging. It is challenging, especially now. There's like a torrent of information, you know, there's a flood of information, you know, and it is difficult to keep track of what's real, what's not, what's hype, what's not. You know, you don't wanna be Fox 5 passing on The Sopranos, but at the same time, you don't want to be a Dutch guy buying tulips, you know? So it's, I'll be the first to admit that I do my best, basically. Okay, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that. There is a matter of just your intuitions, right? There is a matter of, like, just knowing kind of what generally seems to be possible in the world today. And so when somebody says, we have this great new thing, then you have to kind of compare it to what can we do now? And as people say, in general, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, you know? So... Grant, okay, here's an example. I was pretty much ignoring generative AI throughout most of 2022 because previous times of what I'd seen with text generation of AI, I was like, well, okay, it's decent enough, you know, but it's kooky. You can clearly tell. And then I wrote a brief article about it, about how cyber criminals were using ChatGPT to write polymorphic malware, and malware that was able to adjust its own code on the fly based upon the defenses that it encounters. And that freaked me out. I was like, wait, what? I remember looking into that, and that's when I first logged on to ChatGPT. And like a lot of people, when they first encounter it, I went through a period of obsession and just trying to feed it as many things as possible, just trying to like test its limit, frankly, trying to break it, trying to see like what it can't do. And then after like a little while, coming out the other end, being just like, okay, that's pretty impressive. I don't really think that it's apocalyptic the way that certain people talk about it. But I mean, at the same time, I do think it's more than just spicy autocomplete. It does seem to represent something larger that is going on. But anyway, so getting back to this point though, is a lot of it is just investigating, you know, yourself, looking at these things yourself, comparing it to what you know is available, what you know, the capabilities that are around today, and just kind of processing it, just kind of working with it, and seeing does it feel real to you? Does it feel okay? How does this seem, you know, to you in that regard? But you know, it can still be a difficult thing to do. It can still be a difficult thing to parse. Marketing can be pretty clever in that regard. And there's a lot of what somebody else had referred to as AI washing nowadays. You know, there's a lot of stuff that they'll say like, okay, like the fundamental product may not change, but now their marketing all says powered by AI or something like that. But the definition of AI has been stretched so broad lately to basically mean any process requiring intelligence that is done by computer. And so, I mean, that, what doesn't that cover? What does that not describe, you know, and anymore? Or the other thing too is that I think that by AI washing things, sometimes you can inadvertently denigrate your own product. So there'll be something that says like, we have all these powerful AIs, and I look at it and I'm just like, well, you have a lot of algorithms, and these are pretty cool algorithms. And I'm like, what's wrong with an algorithm? What's wrong with saying I have a really cool algorithm? I mean, I guess what's wrong with it is that it's not comporting with the current trend in technology, you know, and that's, I guess that's what you want to do. But still, I feel like a lot of the times when people are talking about AI this, AI that, a lot of it really isn't necessary, but it's people, I don't know, trying to like latch on to the newest trend or something like that, which I don't know, I guess that's just the nature of technological change in and of itself.
Yeah, and I think it adds to the complexity of how we connect with our audiences, right? You as a journalist, myself as a consultant, you know, recognizing that a large pool of the folks who are in our audience, whether I'm you know, speaking at an event or whatever, they're reading one of your articles, right? That they are not as intensely following these trends or maybe hands-on testing them out themselves. And that cloud of, well, everybody's calling themselves AI, so I guess that's AI, right? That morphs their perception, their understanding of what those technologies are, which dilutes what it really is when you and I might be talking about it.
I had been meaning to bring this up, I had forgotten about it, but I use this heuristic in a lot of parts of my life, not just technology. And it's remarkably depressing. But I have found that the less satisfying an answer is, the more likely it is that it's true, because life is immensely complicated. And so even in the realm of questions, let's say, I talk to a lot of accountants and I might be like, is X going to have an impact on Y? And they'll get real thoughtful and they'll be saying, then they'll say, well, it depends. And the thing is, well, it depends. It is probably the most accurate answer that you could give, but it's not really the answer you were looking for. You wanted definitiveness. You wanted certainty. You wanted to say, yes, it will do this. And very similarly with technology, kind of going along the same lines of extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. You know, if a new tech is coming out that is going to make you better looking, healthier, it's going to like grow your hair back or something like that, you know, if it's the real deal, fantastic, but that would make me far too happy. All of these things would be far too cool. And this world is not very cool. So therefore, this probably isn't very cool. This probably isn't like what it's saying is. Let me investigate this. Let me see what this really is. And sometimes it is the real deal. Sometimes it is what it actually says it is, you know? But my dad, a lot of things are so much more boring and mundane and regular and ordinary than you would think. There's nothing wrong with that. The world is full. The world runs on boring, ordinary, mundane things. Without boring, ordinary, mundane things, I feel like a lot of stuff would just fall apart right away, you know? But I just keep this heuristic in mind a lot. It's like, my skepticism should rise in direct proportion to my enthusiasm. The more I like something, the more skeptical I should be of it.
I think that's fair. So from a journalistic perspective, you're not necessarily going to write an article that's titled, you won't believe these 10 things that whatever, you know.
I try to avoid that. I kind of think listicles have been kind of killing a lot of, I don't know. I'm not the biggest fan of that kind of reporting. But at the same time, I also know that it is quite a lucrative kind of reporting. And so just, you know, industries generally being what they are, I mean, why wouldn't a publication, you know, write a lot of stuff along those lines? You know, it's a real tragedy of the commons. I try to avoid that if I can.
Yeah. To your point on kind of dampening that, like I've learned to expect that if it says you won't believe what so-and-so just did or said, usually I'm like, yeah, no, I believe that. I'm sorry. I clicked on the article, but I do believe that. So, speaking of kind of the public domain of things we consume, right? So, yeah. a lot these days seems to be all or none. It's either, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread, or it's the end of days. You do a great job in one of your recent articles entitled "Leaders Split on Whether AI Will Reduce Headcount." You do a great job detailing the nuances of the equation, and to your point around the
Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean that with honesty. You know, to your point around the "it depends" answer, I think you gave a lot of context. For instance, the roles needed to lead, implement, and govern AI are probably going to require unique skill sets. So it's not necessarily, you're not just looking at the pool of resources that you have today and saying, will that grow or contract? But it's going to change as it potentially grows or contracts. And that will be different for different folks based on the size and complexity of the organization, the technical capacity of their existing resources. You know, you're probably going to end up with very different resource configurations. Can you comment on why this is such a shift in mindset from maybe just a few years ago when tax and technology, it was predominantly the adoption of a tax engine?
I mean, my first thought was likely because the technology itself has improved. And so I think that what people are able to do with software, what people are able to do with technology likely has expanded greatly since then. And so there's just more solutions to more things, to more things out there. And I think kind of similarly, there's the more talent getting into this sector. You know, I see a lot of marketing copy, a lot of ads, you know, like our developer is an alum from Google. You know, this was developed by a team that came from Microsoft or what have you. So a lot of the talent that was concentrated in the tech industry is distributing now too. So we're seeing more skill in software development entering the industry as well. I mean, we also see this in the hires of large firms, you know, and the increasing use of just technological specialists in all of that. Now, I think too, and this is a little bit chicken and egg maybe, but business model changes as well. It's not just enough that a lot of people aren't necessarily looking for purely compliance practices from their accounting firms anymore. They don't want to just file their taxes. They want to have insight on their taxes. They want to have strategies for their taxes, things along those lines, you know, and that tends to involve more analysis, more data analytics and stuff like that. But it could also be that the technology enabled more of these insights to be generated, which therefore can encourage business model changes. That's why I kind of brought up the chicken and egg aspect of it. But I think the technology has just improved. I think that when a tax engine was the main concern that you had, there just wasn't as much on the market, maybe. I mean, that's just my overall estimation. I got a pretty dang good feeling there's a lot that I'm not even thinking about at this point. Just to go on with the unsatisfying, like, sort of like, I can't say definitively, this is kind of my thought, you know, but I'm sure, just like the report that you had read, it's going to depend upon who you ask.
No, I tend to agree with you, right? I think in the tax engine era, let's just call it, right? From a resource perspective, the goal was, you know, can I give this to my tax accountants and they can use it? And please, if any way possible, can we just not involve IT? Like, how do we bring in technology and not involve IT? And then there was the trends of, you know, how do we have slightly more advanced technologies and evolve some of the tax accountants to be able to do, you know, to be dangerous enough with analytics or, you know, data transformation, things like that. But now where we are with the democratization of data and of really sophisticated tools, you know, the lens through enterprise data cannot be ignored, you know, so there's this kind of, there's this momentum that in order to get those insights that you mentioned, you have to take a more holistic data governance and access and security and, you know, ecosystem approach, which is probably going to involve IT as strategic stakeholders, and then that mix of technological prowess, you know, at different levels within the tax team itself, if not a tax technology team embedded in tax as well.
You know, something just came to mind right now is you had talked about how, so we've been seeing just more of a trend towards a holistic strategic view of an organization. Like like, you know, back in the day, your finance department at a given organization, you know, they were paying your taxes, they were paying your vendors, they were getting the checks, processing the checks. Nowadays, you read about finance leaders and they're expected to be strategic partners. You know, they're expected to produce insights, they're expected because they have this data to basically be able to apply that towards larger value growth at the company overall. And I'm realizing, well, not realizing, but I'm thinking about how you had said people before didn't want to involve IT, but IT now, because honestly, it's a rare company that is completely severed from tech now. Like IT is also more expected to provide this strategic broad role. IT now also, IT does more than just maintain the servers and keep malware out of your emails. You know, IT also is a part in all of this. And I think this speaks to these silos being broken down in recent years and taking a more whole organization viewpoint you know, towards things. It was just something I kind of was thinking about with there.
Yeah, that idea of the strategic value of tax is nothing new, but it's funny because if you go back 10 years or so and try and figure out, well, why aren't most tax departments serving that role as strategic advisors to the business, you might have pontificated on a host of different reasons, but now you see today what's possible with everything that's happened since then. You're like, oh, because all of these different variables didn't click into place, the technology, the integration with IT, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And the other thing too is that you have, look, I don't want to be mean, like sometimes you will have incumbent leaders who just, they don't really want to change. They're comfortable with the way things are. Running things this way made me very successful 15, 20 years ago. I don't want to change the thing that made me very successful when it may not necessarily be serving them well, or maybe it's maintaining things. Maybe it's keeping things afloat, but they're not really thriving. And maybe they're okay with not thriving. Maybe they just kind of want to maintain their company to keep a roof over their head and food on their table. They're not looking to like strike it rich or something like that, you know. But regardless of mindset, I do also though think there is a hesitance to change. There's a hesitance to changing your processes to something you may not necessarily understand 100%, and therefore cannot properly evaluate the quality of 100%, versus keeping people bound to a process that you know how well people are and aren't doing, and therefore you know how well an individual is or is not doing at this thing you told them to do. So that could also just be another sort of motivation there. And I think that like it's not everyone has to be like completely and utterly tapped up, because there are certain clients, I don't know how many of them, maybe there are certain clients that really just do want to have a compliance service done or something like that, you know. But as far as like thriving goes, as far as like being able to expand, I feel like you can't ignore technology nowadays. If you're going to participate in the modern economy, then you're probably going to need modern tools. And more of that involves digitization, that involves, you know, online things, stuff along those lines. I mean, again, I don't want to like say that it can't be possible. All things are possible. But I mean, even if you're running an apple butter farm in upstate New York and you're picking all of your own apples and processing it by hand, I'm going to guess you still have a website. If nothing else, I'm going to guess maybe you have a phone number. I don't know. Again,
or at the very least, they've got they probably got Square or something that you could do some, you know, card payments or mobile payments or something.
Mm-hmm. All things are possible, but it's tough to imagine anyway.
So it's like a young Chris Gaetano ditching his sopping wet flip phone for a smartphone for the first time. Some sort of inflection point that there's no turning back.
Mm. And here's the thing too, is like, I mean, that whole thing with Michael and my experience, I didn't even realize how much more I could do. And then once I did, I was like, why did I wait so long? Do you mean to tell me I could put all of my music on here? I don't have to carry around my phone and a device and my headphones and this, you know, like, wow. You're just telling me I can watch a movie on, oh my goodness. But yeah. So sometimes like you're not even aware of the advantages you're missing out on. But you know what? Here's the thing too. Sometimes you are perfectly aware of it. And not every firm can afford to drop a whole year's worth of revenue on tech upgrades.
Yeah, I've certainly seen that. And I think that is poised to change, just my own personal opinion. I think things like Copilot that are coming down the pike, I think there's going to be a lot of ability for those smaller firms who don't have additional budget for licenses to be able to do things that they couldn't do in the past technologically. Mm-hmm. But the barrier there is another thing you mentioned is spending that time to figure out what could I be doing and what do I need to prepare myself to be able to do the things. I'm hoping that's a little bit of what this podcast serves, is to just lay out those, oh, here's something maybe I should pay attention to or not. I heard somebody on a podcast years ago talking about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin when it was new, and it was nothing that I had personally had experience with. And I almost felt like he was speaking to me directly when he was saying, you know, there's so many people out there that don't know how this works. Easiest thing to do, just go buy a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Just a fraction of a coin, and just see how the process works when you transact, when you own it and then you sell it. And if you don't do that, you'll never have any clue. And I think that's part of that. You know, I need to dedicate a little bit of time, carve it out here or there, knowing that there's so much change in the industry and in technology and in my competitors and peers. Let me just carve out a little bit of time and just try something out.
When you talked about licensing, one of the things that I've actually noticed is that the licensing of generative AI is allowing companies, I think, to punch well above their weight. As time goes on, and this whole idea of licensing your sophisticated AIs, I'm sure there's going to be other models, ones that are perhaps less prone to hallucination, you know, ones that maybe are better at math, you know, that can be for accounts. But overall, this idea of being able to access it without having to drop like so much money on developing your own model, I think could wind up equalizing things at least a little bit, could wind up changing the game. Of course, as I say this now, the mega companies will probably be developing AIs that are even more sophisticated still. But, you know, who knows? We'll. What I often say is that the only thing we know for sure is that we don't know anything for sure.
Which brings me to my last question, Chris. I assume you have a crystal ball and you could tell the future. So I'm looking to you to tell us what's going to happen next.
All right. So if we're going to go on just trends based upon what I've been seeing and what I've been reporting, what I've been talking to, I think that we are going to be seeing the proliferation of generative AI, whether people developing their own models or people licensing other people's models in software solutions. I think we're going to be seeing AI being used. I mean, we're already seeing AI being used in accounting pretty extensively, even before generative AI really hit the scene. You know, I mean, an AI can audit an entire data set versus having to like sample, or even worse, having to send an army of first years to a warehouse to pick up receipts, you know. But I think that we're going to see an acceleration of that. I think that we are going to be seeing more lean on automation. We're going to be seeing just more. And because more of these routine tasks will be automated, I think we're going to be seeing a heavier emphasis on advisory, on like, well, we have all this data, we have all this information, now what? Now what do we do with it, you know? And thankfully, you have a professional who is well aware of all of these things. But at the same time, I kind of was thinking, and I've been talking about this, I do believe that when we get a huge technological change like, you know, generative AI, that everyone and their mother seems to be building in to every single thing that they're doing, I think that the shape of what will, I think, eventually be an AI bubble will be eventually when so many companies stuff so many things with questionable AI that doesn't really add value, that doesn't really have much to do with the core product even, or if it does have to do with the core product, maybe hasn't done it very well or something like that. There will be too many people, I think, trying to just catch the hype, catch the trend, slap an AI sticker on their product. And I think people are eventually going to get frustrated with that. And it's going to sour people, I think, on AI for a while. I do think that eventually, as time goes on, we will see the rise of more mature companies that have learned from this extremely white hot period, you know, that we're in right now. But I don't know, I think that in the immediate future, one of the things that I am concerned about is what had, again, that term AI washing, this idea that like people can stuff AI into things that for whatever, just to say that you could, you know, just to say that we use AI in this. And it needs to be used in a specific way. It needs to be for a specific problem. And it honestly needs to be the best solution for that problem. You know, it may not necessarily be. Or you may be applying the wrong type of AI. You may be trying to do, you put a generative AI model in there where, like, I don't know, a knowledge engine or something like that would have been a better fit. Overall, I think that we're going to be seeing more and more hype, and I think that eventually people are going to get frustrated. That's going to sour people on a lot of AI, and I think that it'll take a while for other more mature companies to start rising, but I think that eventually they will, having learned then from that hype cycle. That is my prediction. You know, once the singularity arrives and AI has taken over the world, I'm sure this interview will be played for great amusement, you know, by people in the future, by the AI overlords in the future, maybe. And yeah, maybe there will be no AI bubble. Maybe we will all just be in AI. Who knows? Again, as I talked about before, I do my best. I do my best with what I've got, you know, but anything can happen. Anything can happen.
Well, if history is any indicator, I mean, it sounds like what you were saying is almost exactly what happened with bots. Its first go around, right? With RPA, is people.
Oh yeah.
Everyone wanted bots, and everyone's talking about bots, and they spent all this time writing bots and documenting, mm-hmm. probably not realizing upfront how much time they were going to spend writing and documenting. And then there were so many people where bots was a four-letter word proverbially. Mm-hmm. They couldn't even talk about it. But you're right. You got to kind of then get. You have to oscillate back to, well, there is a right time and a place for this type of technology. You know, I rode the hype. I got burned. I wasted a bunch of time. You know, now what are we really going to use it for? I think you're right. I think it'll be something similar to that, or the robot apocalypse, one or the other.
Oh, here's a really good example, actually. So,
you remember a robot apocalypse?
Well, no, about the former. You know how, like, for a while, everyone was talking about the metaverse? And everyone was exploring the metaverse. Everyone was buying land in the metaverse, things like that. And now we don't hear much from it. But then I was at a conference and I was talking to somebody and he was saying, well, what we do with the metaverse is we work with insurance companies and they recreate like buildings in the metaverse that they can then look through and explore to assess damages and stuff like that. And I was like, now that is a use case. Mm-hmm. Now that is something I can see actually driving value. Having a dance party with a bunch of NFTs, maybe not. Maybe that would be for like recruiting younger tech savvy people. I don't know. But I think that I'm not going to say that the metaverse, the idea of the metaverse is utterly useless. There's nothing there. But I think that people are now being like, okay, let's be serious here. What do we actually use this for? And we'll start seeing actual use cases, like real use cases for that. And yeah, and I feel like we'll see the same thing with generative AI.
To paraphrase Dr. Ian Malcolm, technology finds a way.
It absolutely does. And you know what? The tech gods can be capricious and arbitrary. Sometimes they give it, sometimes they take it away.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, I think that's a perfect place to end our conversation. I really, Beautiful. Really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, of course. Thank you very much for having me. It's very interesting to be on the other side of these things.
Absolutely. Cheers. Thanks so much, Chris.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Tax at the Speed of Tech, a BDO podcast. If you like the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Head to BDO.com to access resources cited in this episode and learn more about BDO's approach to tax innovation. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, or if you want to discuss your organization's tax technology strategy, send us an email at tax@thespeedoftech@BDO.com.